Silence. All stand for His Honour the Queen's Judge.
You should read the charge.
It is alleged that in the year of 2015, and in the country of New Zealand, Magna Carta is irrelevant and obsolete.
For the prosecution.
May it please the court, Honour with learned friend Ms. Mihiata Pirini for the prosecution.
Mr. Honour, and for the defence.
May it please the court, this is Ms. Turan for the defence with my learned friend Mr. Roycroft.
Thank you, Ms. Turan. Mr. Honour.
Well, pleases. A somewhat melancholy task for the prosecution, Your Honour, to demonstrate, as we will, that Magna Carta is both irrelevant and obsolete in 2015. The nature of this proceeding is slightly obscure, but I'm going to claim it as a declaratory proceeding, which gives us a slightly lower burden of proof. But on the balance of probabilities, it's absolutely clear-cut that that proposition can be made out. And therefore, we will treat prosecution as a somewhat convenient misnomer for a form of indictment of that ancient document. But we do accept the conventional restrained approach that's conventional for prosecutions. There won't be any cheap rhetoric from us, or not much anyway. There is a serious proposition in this, that is to say that Magna Carta is irrelevant or obsolete or both. The fact is that if we establish that proposition, as I will submit that we have in due course, it doesn't actually affect our law or our society. What it does do is cause painful damage to various people's beliefs and expectations. But in the process, it may be that we learn something useful about what matters and what doesn't. So as I proceed, what I propose to do is to first say something about what Magna Carta is, something about the context, something about it as law, something about it as myth, and then a brief conclusion in relation to those matters. And all the points that I make some of the points I make will be expanded in a bit more detail, a bit more authority by my learned friend Ms. Pirini. So what are we talking about when we talk about Magna Carta? Well, we're here because it's the 800th anniversary of Magna Carta, we're told. That takes us back to 1215. So we're dealing with a 1215 version. And that document was 63 clauses and they were written in Latin. And that basically means they're inaccessible to 99% of the population then, and indeed if they were still in Latin they'd be inaccessible to a slightly higher percentage of the population now, probably. As a matter of English law, I suspect that probably more than 99% of New Zealanders have not read Magna Carta, and nor can they be blamed for not doing so. The English translation is one that is better known, and it's probably important that I say something about the accepted translation so there is a slight sense, or slightly better sense, of what it is we're talking about. Now, we have provided for those who are observing this process a very small piece of paper which sets out, on the one side, chapters 39 and 40 in English, on the other side, chapters 39 and 40 in Latin, and people appreciate that the Latin doesn't help us a great deal. So this text was originally Latin. But the English translation, and which everybody is forgiven for not trying to read the one up on the court front, commences, John, by the grace of God, King of England, Lord of Ireland, Duke of Normandy and Aquitaine, Count of Anjou, to the archbishops, bishops, abbots, earls, barons, justiciars, foresters, sheriffs, stewards, servants, and all his officials and faithful subjects, greeting, know that we, from reverence for God, for the salvation of our soul, and those all our ancestors and heirs, for the honour of God and the exaltation of Holy Church, and the reform of our realm, have agreed to what follows. But that tells us a number of things. It tells us that we're talking about a bygone age when the King of England happened to be the Lord of Ireland, the Duke of Normandy and Aquitaine, the Count of Anjou, and the people he was addressing as the most important people in the land were archbishops, bishops, abbots, earls, barons, justiciars, foresters and sheriffs. If that doesn't establish obsolescence, it's hard to know what else would. But when we turn to the text, we see even more of this is established. Clause 1. In the first place, he says, I'm giving you these provisions of my own free will, although of course he uses the real royal plural, of our own free will, before the quarrel between us and our barons began.
But that's simply the church, isn't it? Provisions relating to the church.
That part, chapter 1, is solely about the church. And so what he's saying is importance of freedom of elections solely in relation to the church, as Your Honour says. Then he goes on to refer to the Lord Pope Innocent, again indicating a rather different time, although it was a rather more effective multinational organisation, perhaps, than these days. If we move through and just take a few at random propositions from the text, just again so we can see what we're talking about. Clause 28, no constable or any other of our bailiffs shall take any man's corn or other chattels unless he pays cash for them at once or can delay payment with the agreement of the seller. Very reasonable, although probably not much corn to be found among the chattels in most households these days, but I'll come back to that because it has some current relevance across the Pacific. Chapter 32, we will not hold the lands of convicted felons for more than a year and a day. That's quite handy. You convict somebody and take their lands, you can use them for a year and a day, and after that they get returned to the lords. Number 33, henceforth all fish weirs shall be completely removed from the Thames and the Medway and throughout all England, except on the seacoast. Again, speaking of obsolescence in a rather effective way. And then the famous ones for present purposes, 39 and 40, no free man shall be taken or imprisoned or deceased or outlawed or exiled or in any way ruined, nor we go or send against him, except by the lawful judgment of his peers or by the law of the land. And 40, to no one will we sell, to no one will we deny or delay right or justice. And I'll come back to those. 47, all forests which have been afforested in our time shall be disafforested at once, and river banks which we have enclosed in our time shall be treated similarly. It does sound on the face of it like all trees are supposed to be cut down, but it doesn't mean that. It means that the king could no longer, at least as long as this document lasted, have the rents from the forest lands or lands which were deemed to be forest lands. And then paragraph 50, giving us the minutiae, we will dismiss completely from their offices the relations of Gerard Dutte, that henceforth they should have no office in England. And then it names another half a dozen people who are out of a job. And then, to indicate the status of social life, chapter 54, no one shall be taken or imprisoned upon the appeal of a woman for the death of anyone except her husband. So by the time we go through these, and the same thing applies to almost all the rest of it, there's really nothing in here that has any relevance to present society. Clauses 39 and 40, as I've mentioned, have been slightly tweaked on the way to the 1297 version, and that, as we will hear quite a lot of, no doubt, is the version that's still found in New Zealand's law as part of the Imperial Laws Application Act of 1988. But our focus is on the 1215 document as law and as myth. They are the two dimensions that we need to address, and we will. And our submission is that this long, technical, turgid, and translated document is truly obsolete. And I owe some of those adjectives to Lord Sumption, an address I'll come back to. And it's irrelevant in both dimensions. Now, in the way in which at least modern lawyers approach legal issues, it's necessary to say something about context. In fact, normally too much about context, but let me try and offer a few thoughts on context. Firstly, the context of the Magna Carta is effectively the Norman Conquest. And in fact, if you wanted to be brutal about it, it's about a bunch of French families squabbling over the enjoyment of the fruits of aggravated robbery in the form of the invasion of 1066. If one goes to check out, as one of the recent books by Lord Judge does, the identities of the barons who were at Runnymede, they are all from Norman families or places close to Normandy who had come across with or just after the Norman invasion, at the point where the Normans took over England and displaced the Saxons. In the language of the 19th century in North America, they would have been thought as carpetbaggers, although carpetbaggers possibly weren't developed at that stage. So there was a major squabble going on between the barons and the king. As I indicated earlier, he was acknowledged in the preface to the Magna Carta. But it was especially about the cost of the king's wars, because the king was trying to expand the territory in France and meeting some degree of resistance. This all cost money, and unsurprisingly, those who had money were reluctant to pay it over in the form of some kind of taxation or equivalent. Now, there's a bit of a debate about whether you can look at context that occurs after the events that you're dealing with. In fact, it's probably a heresy to do so, but I may as well mention that the king reneged on the deal, the pope annulled the deal, and the squabbling continued for some centuries, all of which demonstrates that as a political compact, it was something of a failure as well. And beyond that, there is complete uncertainty. As was pointed out in an interesting address by Lord Neuberger, given in England around the time of the anniversary earlier this year, he points out that there is nothing written in a contemporary manner. No one knows exactly what was said or done on the day, except that the document was produced. All that we know was only produced decades, if not centuries later, and that is one of the reasons why the matter or the document has really developed more as a myth than as something that reflects a particular context or a thought-out set of political concepts. So, Magna Carta is law. The obsolescence aspect of this is relatively straightforward. First of all, it starts off with the idea of an activist and personal monarch. And in our time, we are freed from that particular issue. We have a constitutional monarchy, which in a sense means that it doesn't matter too much. Whereas clearly the whole point of Magna Carta was that King John mattered a great deal, which is why the barons were trying to get a headlock on him. As I mentioned, only two provisions from the original 63 have survived as part of New Zealand law, and there's a reason for that. The other 61 are simply anachronistic, or obsolete. Irrelevance. Sadly, those two provisions that I read out, 39 and 40, about freemen and not selling justice, are never in fact relied on or applied in New Zealand. And that's partly because of the out clause. What it says is you can't do various things unless it's governed by the law of the land. And so it's reasonably effective for somebody to have a regulation or statute that covers the point, no matter how unsatisfactory it might seem, particularly to those who are at the sharp end of whatever the regulation is. Now, I mentioned Clause 38. This is the one about not taking the corn unless you pay cash for them. And you might think that's a fine indication of property protection. And you might think that property protection is part of New Zealand law. But on the whole, you might be a bit disappointed. In New Zealand, it's been accepted that Magna Carta doesn't help in dealing with issues where legislation has interfered with property rights. I have the distinct recollection of Justice McGeoch saying in a courtroom not far from here that you couldn't regard Magna Carta as some early form of the Public Works Act, which provides compensation for land that is taken. And that contrasts the United States situation, where the United States has been probably more enthusiastic than the British have about Magna Carta. And in their Fifth Amendment, they have a rule against takings, that there cannot be takings without just compensation. And that has been developed very substantially. Indeed, the most recent case is only last month, in a case involving the production of raisins and the proposition that the government could take a share of it to try and discourage overproduction was held to be something that required compensation because of the Fifth Amendment, with express reference back to Clause 28 of the Magna Carta itself. But in New Zealand, we give a rather low profile of property. It doesn't even get mentioned in the Bill of Rights Act. And one of the points that is, I think, emerges when one looks at the Bill of Rights and Magna Carta is that we have a sense that somehow or other the protections that North Americans enjoy, for example, in relation to property, are guaranteed here by Magna Carta. And it's simply wrong. That's one of the reasons why, as a matter of law, Magna Carta is either not functioning and possibly dangerous because it misleads people. So the general proposition in relation to Magna Carta as law is it's obsolete. The language is inaccessible, it has no practical use, and it probably encourages disrespect for the statute book and being something that isn't particularly useful. In short, it was a document for 1215, it's not a document for 2015. Magna Carta is myth. In our submission, this is actually the more serious point, because you can have a duff statute, we've got a few of those, but having a myth that you really can't rely on is actually much more troublesome if it's an important myth. And this one is important. But if it's going to create political complacency, about how our system actually works, then it's dangerous. Now, nobody will yield to the prosecution's enthusiasm for the rule of law as a vital concept in running the society that we enjoy. But it's an idea that doesn't depend on Magna Carta. It precedes Magna Carta in some forms, and it crystallizes into a modern form much later, principally in the 17th century. And so the general proposition is that we have to depend on eternal vigilance to try and maintain the society and the customs that we wish to have. And what Magna Carta does is to encourage complacency. That complacency is reinforced by the idea of a lawyer myth. The myth, most of those who speak of Magna Carta in glowing terms are lawyers, including judges of very senior ranks in the United Kingdom. Beyond that, it hasn't had a great deal of effect. It doesn't have a great deal of utility. It's also being reinforced by misguided non-lawyers. And in that context, recalling Shelley's proposition that poets are the unacknowledged legislators of the world, I should mention that one of the unfortunate developments in the myth-making is in fact that well-known legislator Rudyard Kipling. And Kipling wrote a poem called The Reeds of Runnymede, and it has five stanzas, which I won't read them all, but stanza three, for example: "When through our ranks the barons came with little thought of praise or blame, but resolute to play the game, they lumbered up to Runnymede, and there they launched in solid line the first attack on right divine, the curt, uncompromising sign that settled John at Runnymede. At Runnymede, your rights were won at Runnymede. No freeman shall be fined or bound or dispossessed of freehold ground, except by lawful judgment found and passed upon him by his peers. Forget not, after all these years, the charter signed at Runnymede." Now, just to be clear, Runnymede is where this thing was signed. So it's very attractive, doggerel, but in fact, what it does is reinforce the proposition that our rights are bound up in Magna Carta. Meanwhile, they're being nibbled in all sorts of other directions and have been and may be, and the very idea that it is of some real protection is a problem. In terms of continuing modern culture, I should mention in passing for a generation younger than myself that in Lord Newburgh's speech about this document, he finished up looking at J.Z., who is a much more modern poet, who has in fact got an album which refers to Magna Carta in the title, but Lord Newburgh and I, having looked at some of the lyrics, find it completely obscure why he's referred to Magna Carta at all. That itself may tell us something about obsolescence and irrelevance. And the point is well made elsewhere, and I won't go into the detail, but in effect, Magna Carta adds nothing to the libertarian tradition of which we are rightly proud as having inherited from the British Isles. That really comes from the Bill of Rights and the arrangements of the 17th century. When you come to the rule of law, you take a leading book like Tamanaha's text, doesn't even mention the Magna Carta. So in the result, we say that as a matter of law, Magna Carta is both irrelevant and obsolete. As a matter of myth, it's also irrelevant and obsolete. Indeed, it's downright misleading. So make no mistake, the rule of law is precious, but eternal vigilance of judges and indeed voters is required, and what Magna Carta offers is simply misleading sentiment. May it please the Court.
Mr. Hunter. Jr. Ms. Kearney.
If Your Honour pleases, on the charge that Magna Carta is irrelevant and obsolete, I have two submissions. My first submission concerns the specific effect of Chapter 29 of the 1297 version of Magna Carta, which, as Your Honour knows, is the only provision of Magna Carta that's currently on the New Zealand Statute Book, appearing in Schedule 1 of the Imperial Laws Application Act 1988. I submit that has no legal use. It guarantees no rights that cannot be enforced through other contemporary legislation, and as a specific provision, it is obsolete. And my second submission concerns Magna Carta as a symbol. I submit that the values of the rule of law and parliamentary democracy can be celebrated in their own right, and that the court should actively disavow the myth of Magna Carta, which has no meaning apart from in the legal community. Turning to my first submission, which is on chapter 29 of Magna Carta, and that it has no legal use. On this point, Your Honour, chapter 29 has been argued to encompass, for example, the following rights: the right to be tried without undue delay. In chapter 29, we will not deny or defer to any man either justice or right. And the right to be tried by jury: we will not pass upon him nor condemn him, but by lawful judgment of his peers or by the law of the land. Now, of course, both of those rights are enshrined in modern legislation in the form of the New Zealand Bill of Rights Act 1990, and so it is unnecessary for litigants to approach the court on the basis of Magna Carta guaranteeing them those rights. A third right that is often said to be contained in Chapter 29 of Magna Carta is the right to be free from seizure of one's property. No free man shall be disseized of his freehold. Now, on that point, I would cite to the court the case of Westco Lagan Limited and Attorney General, 2001-1 New Zealand Law Reports 40 in the High Court. This was a case that concerned the cancellation by statute of an accord between the Crown and a group of sawmillers, which provided that no compensation would be payable. And the claimants argued that the cancelled accord had created property rights and that the relevant non-compensation clause amounted to a seizure of those rights under Magna Carta. And Justice McGeachin dealt with this point relatively shortly. He noted the need for an ambulatory interpretation, but thought that it was stretching Chapter 29 of the statute too far to suggest that it could apply to the factual situation at hand, which was the abolition of contractual rights to supply of goods without compensation. And His Honour said that this was a very different factual situation to a person being disseized of his freehold, which, His Honour noted, refers to an interest in land. And he concluded by observing that Magna Carta has its place, but he was not much minded to view it as some early Public Works Act compensation statute, as senior counsel has already noted. And so, Your Honour, I suggest that Justice McGeachin's statements illustrate that the court is not particularly tempted to bring Magna Carta into the 21st century and to use it to creatively protect property rights when that is actually dealt with through contemporary legislation. Chapter 29 is therefore obsolete, and I submit it should be removed from the statute book. Your Honour, I turn now to my second submission, which concerns the symbolic value of Magna Carta. Now, it is said mainly by lawyers that Magna Carta symbolises the rule of law and parliamentary democracy. But senior counsel has already established that the rule of law has its roots elsewhere. And on that point, I would simply draw Your Honour's attention to the historical analysis of Lord Sumption, British judge, author and medieval historian, who noted that at the time Magna Carta was signed, it was already well understood by the king's subjects that the king was subject to the law. In other words, that rule of law existed. In 1100, specifically, Henry I had sworn an oath to observe the laws and customs of England, and Lord Sumption notes that the English people knew of that oath, that they relied on it to resist the king's demands, and that they regarded it as law. That was the rule of law, essentially, in action, and thus, over 200 years later, when Magna Carta was actually signed, it was already relatively orthodox thinking that the king was subject to the law. And finally, as noted by senior counsel, the rule of law as we know it today was crystallised much later in the 17th century. And so we can see that Magna Carta was not the origin of the rule of law, and it was not responsible for developing it to the form that we know it today. On the second point of the symbolism that Magna Carta is often said to hold, the foundations of parliamentary democracy, so this idea that government power must be subject to a body that is representative of the people, I submit, Your Honour, that Magna Carta, having been signed in 1215, it was signed at a time when there was nothing recognisable as a representative parliament. That didn't occur until much later, until the second half of the 13th century. And so, really, Magna Carta did not go any way towards repositioning the king into the king in parliament, which is the form of constitutionalism that we have today. And so, Your Honour, if Magna Carta is not the origin either of the rule of law or parliamentary democracy, we must ask the question, why are we still encouraged to celebrate it? And on that point, I come to the essence of my second submission. It is mainly lawyers, judges and academics who talk about Magna Carta. It is lawyers who revere it. And it is lawyers who have elevated it to its current position, beginning with Sir Edward Cook. Your Honour, I have endeavoured to find out what some non-lawyers think about Magna Carta, and I have conducted a survey of members of my entire extended family, which is actually quite large, and it has no lawyers in it whatsoever. It's a glorious mix, basically, of political persuasions of Māori and Pākehā, group of well-educated and informed people, but zero lawyers, apart from myself. Now, when I asked them, do you know what Magna Carta is, the answers were routinely as follows. No idea. I don't know what that is. I'm off to Google it now. And one rather optimistic suggestion that it might be a new flavour of ice cream. Now, if I had asked about the Treaty of Waitangi or even the rule of law itself, I suggest that there would have been a firmer grasp of its relevance. But asking about Magna Carta draws nothing but blank stares. And so why is it put up as a vehicle through which to celebrate values like the rule of law? Why not celebrate the rule of law itself? Why not ask people to spend their valuable time and attention on those constitutional documents that are unique to New Zealand and that actually have some practical use, like the Bill of Rights Act, the Constitution Act 1986, and of course the Treaty of Waitangi? Your Honour, I submit that the harm of the myth has a practical illustration in the record of unfortunate litigants who have approached the courts with the argument that modern legislation passed by Parliament infringes on rights protected by Magna Carta. And as you will know, Your Honour, those arguments are simply wrong in law, because Magna Carta is not a supreme constitutionally enacted provision to which all local statutes must conform. Parliament is entirely free to legislate against it and has done so. And litigants who rely on arguments otherwise are, I suggest, the unwitting victims of the myth that lawyers themselves have propagated. I ask the court to disavow the myth of Magna Carta for the good of New Zealand citizens and for the good of lawyers, so that we do not risk coming off as out of touch, elitist, and frankly ridiculous when we refer to an inaccessible and irrelevant document as foundational and important, when really it is none of those things. Now, in conclusion, Your Honour, I would briefly summarise my argument. First, that the last vestige of Magna Carta remaining on our statute book guarantees no legal rights and may be removed. And I would also encourage the court to disavow the myth of Magna Carta, which perpetuates a culture of legal elitism that harks back to that small group of self-interested barons who first brought the charter before the king. If Your Honour pleases, that is the case for the prosecution.
Thank you, Ms. Queen. Ms. Theron.
Thank you, Your Honour. This year, Magna Carta has been celebrated across the world. Celebrations include articles, speeches, mock trials, documentaries, exhibitions, festivals, specially commissioned artworks, and a church anthem, a new Magna Carta cycle trail, and a deputation of 800 American lawyers visiting Runnymede. For one day, the only four known copies of the 1215 Magna Carta will be brought together for the first time at the British Library. 1,215 people who have won their tickets in a public ballot will get to see them. Now, all these people are either misguided and wasting a lot of probably taxpayers' money, or there is something significant about this document. I will explain why the Magna Carta is important and why the prosecution has not made out its case. My learned junior, Mr. Roycroft, will provide some more detailed examples of its continued relevance today. In a nutshell, my submission is that Magna Carta remains critically relevant today because it is part of our constitution. Magna Carta represents the inspiration for the rule of law, democracy, and international human rights law. Lord Bingham has described it as containing the green shoots of the four pillars of modern civilized society, and those are democracy, the rule of law, freedom of expression, and economic prosperity. Even at the time, Magna Carta recognized rights of the people and represented the first steps towards the necessary conditions for legitimacy of the ruling power. But the circumstances and its exact terms are now much less relevant. Focusing on these, misses the point, which is what it stands for now and represents. In Lord Bingham's words, sometimes the myth is more important than the actuality. And there may even be some truth in Lord Sumption's words in his recent speech that some documents are less important for what they say than for what people wrongly think they say. The Law Commission's very first report, Imperial Legislation in Force in New Zealand, considered the relevance of Magna Carta. The Law Commission, which included my learned friend Mr. Hodder at the time, concluded that the Magna Carta and the various confirmatory statutes of later centuries are critical features of our history and contribute to our political and constitutional principles and systems, are as well part of our living and practical law, providing legal rules for our governance, continue to control important aspects of the relationship between individuals and state.
Continue to control. Did the Law Commission say that?
Yes, continue to control.
Did they say how?
No. But it was a group of statutes that they were talking about, so it will be the combination. My submission addresses two points, and it's the same two points that have been addressed by the prosecution. First, the relevance of the actuality, the Magna Carta's terms and the circumstances in which it was issued, and secondly, what it symbolises today, its constitutional nature and some of the important principles that it symbolises. Starting with what it represented at the time, Magna Carta demonstrated the need for the king to show willingness to engage with the people and embrace restraint in exchange for legitimacy. It was an acknowledgement that the king's power was curbed by law and by the consent of those governed. And it was also an acknowledgement of the importance of due process and that punishment should fit the crime. Clause 29 has already been discussed in some detail by the prosecution. Other clauses were concerned with protecting property. It is true that a few weeks after it was sealed, the Pope annulled it, and then civil war broke out. King John died the following year, leaving his heir, Henry III, on the throne at the age of 9, and things did not look promising. Yet Magna Carta survived. William Marshall, Earl of Pembroke, was appointed regent. He reissued Magna Carta in November 1216 and again in 1217. It was reissued again by King Henry III in 1225, and it was confirmed over 50 times by English kings until well into the 15th century. Its current meaning evolved each time it was affirmed. As a result, it emerged as a legal code which can be described as a living instrument. Magna Carta is an important point in the history of our constitution. Sir Geoffrey Palmer has said that it marked the beginning of constitutionalism. History matters. It has been said that he or she who controls the past controls the future. Our view of history shapes the way we view the present and therefore dictates the answers we offer for existing problems. Indeed, it is essential to understanding the human condition. In the same way, Magna Carta is essential to understanding our constitution.
In what respect?
As
part of a narrative or significant in itself?
As part of a narrative and as significant in itself. And to the extent that it represents the principles underlying so much of our constitution.
Sorry, what principles? It represents that there's a limit to executive power.
Yes.
But beyond that?
And it represents the importance of due process and the importance of the consent.
Legum terrae. The law of the land.
The law of the land.
That's the expression in Article 39.
Is that that language evolved? There was a reference, I think, early on to due process.
Yes, in the 14th century, the language, the phrase due process came in.
It was part of an evolution of the idea, yes. And the Magna Carta represented the beginnings of an identifiable beginning of those ideas. Right. It is true that those ideas may have been around before, but to the extent that people can't pin those down or identify them in a document, they're not able to be given this kind of status that Magna Carta has acquired over time, and And it's, there's something about that, the reissue and the evolving nature of it as a living document that has fixed it in both our the physical law that we have on our books and in the imaginations of lawyers and legal scholars and judges. There are two other points about the circumstances in which the Magna Carta came into being that are important, and that is that they're an important reminder that our democracy took hundreds of years to establish, and that democracy, the rule of law, and individual liberty should never be taken for granted. Turning to the second point, which is what it represents now, the myth point, it is true that Magna Carta started out as an intensely practical compromise between a small group of people. Professor Philip Joseph's text records that it has become an irrepealable fundamental statute. Nothing could remove its imprint from our law and culture, the text says. It is worth going back to basics and considering the nature of a constitution and New Zealand's constitution. In Matthew Palmer's 2006 article, What is New Zealand's Constitution and Who Interprets It?, he describes the constitution as being about public power and how it is exercised. A constitution is made up of the structures, processes, principles, rules, conventions, and even culture that constitute the ways in which public power is exercised. A constitution continually exists in the actions, understandings, and interrelationships of those who operate it. So the New Zealand Constitution exists in a number of significant enactments and other instruments in the common law and in core principles and conventions. Magna Carta is part of that constitution in two ways, which correspond to the actuality and the myth. First, it has long been accepted as one of the formal legal documents which form part of the constitution. Sir Kenneth Heath identified it as one of the relevant English and United Kingdom statutes which are major sources of the constitution in his introduction to the 1990 Cabinet Office Manual, which was revised in 2001 and then again in 2008.
But if the Magna Carta, the 1297 statute, was repealed, nothing would change, would it?
Nothing would. There's so much of our constitution which the same could be said of, Your Honour.
Well, maybe. I mean, if you repealed the Bill of Rights, well, that would make a difference, I think.
It would make a difference to. That would make a difference. Would make certainly make a difference to interpretation, and perhaps repealing Magna Carta might too.
What difference?
In to the extent that they take into account in interpreting other statutes.
I know that Magna Carta is relied on often enough in the United States, and it, in some respects, and some of the clauses became incorporated in the federal and state constitutions and charters. But is there any recent authority in New Zealand or in the United Kingdom or in Australia where the Magna Carta has been seen as being of interpretative significance?
It has in the United States.
Yes, I know it has in the States.
And the United Kingdom judges routinely refer to it. But then don't apply it. But Your Honour, I think, Your Honour, my submission is that the point about a constitution is that is the enforceability in court, what you can do with it in court, how you rely. And this is the point of what a constitution is. So much of our constitution we can't enforce in court, we can't rely on it. And it constrains in different ways. It constrains public actors in different ways because it's part of the fabric of how we think and how we apply and interpret laws. So moving to that point, because that is a point in which the prosecution places considerable emphasis, the extent to which Magna Carta can be applied or enforced in the courts. I've made the point that there's much of our constitution, for example, the treaty, that cannot be enforced in the courts unless it's specifically referred to, the principles are referred to in legislation. Even the New Zealand Bill of Rights Act does not prevail over other legislation. That does not mean it's fundamental. Certainly does not mean it's irrelevant. And that's the point, that constitutional documents constrain public power in a variety of ways, and the courtroom's not the only places, only place where decision makers are held accountable. Another feature of constitutional documents is that how they come to be interpreted may be a little relationship to their meaning at the time they are enacted. This is the nature of legislation generally, because as Section 6 of the Interpretation Act confirms, the statute speaks to the present, but it's even more true of constitutional documents. A very striking example is the US Constitution. No one would suggest that it is obsolete and irrelevant because it originally recognized and protected slavery. And we've seen how the Supreme Court's interpretation of it has shifted over time. In 1972, the US Supreme Court refused to hear Jack Baker's case that limiting marriage to same-sex couples was unconstitutional. Last month, the Supreme Court reversed itself in Obergefell and Hodges. The US Constitution has not changed in any relevant way since Baker made his challenge, but the Supreme Court's view of the legitimacy and constitutionality of same-sex marriage changed radically. In the span of 43 years, the notion went from ridiculous to constitutionally mandated. In the same way, different generations have reinterpreted Magna Carta to match the dominant ideas of the age. Stopping briefly at the West Colagan case, Mr. Hodder's submission that the Magna Carta is misleading and dangerous may be driven largely because of a bad experience before Justice McGeoch back in 2000-2001, where Mr. Hodder was trying to do something really quite ambitious with Magna Carta. Magna Carta is often the refuge of the lay litigant, but that simply demonstrates that, like the New Zealand Bill of Rights Act, it has resonance beyond the world of lawyers. I have a lot more I could say about Magna Carta, but I'm going to have to cut it short. As I've already noted, Lord Neuberger in his recent speech described Magna Carta as containing the green shoots of four fundamental pillars on which a civilized modern democracy is built, and those are democratic government, the rule of law, freedom of expression, and economic prosperity. It's interesting to note how these principles are reflected in three of the six themes identified by New Zealand's Constitutional Advisory Panel in its report in 2013, and they come through in the themes of justice and fairness, including the state's role in ensuring the people's dignity and quality of life, having a voice, and checks and balances, which include the principle that the exercise of public power should be subject to effective limits and accountability. In my submission, not only are these principles, which are symbolized by Magna Carta, relevant, but they are fundamental, and once we focus on those, it becomes clear that the work of Magna Carta is not done. It will continue to be an important part of the debate going forward, well into the future. Those are just my submissions, Your Honour.
Thank you, Mr. Thorne. Mr. Roycroft.
Your Honour, I'd like to finalise the scholarly and erudite contributions of the defence tonight by providing the court with a few examples and illustrations of Magna Carta's continued relevance to New Zealand, both from a domestic perspective and an international perspective. At some point, I'll also attempt to undermine some of the baseless accusations the prosecution have assayed our ears with this evening. But first, I'd just like to outline the four major submissions I have for the court. First, Magna Carta and the Treaty of Waitangi, which has continually been referred to as the Māori Carta. Second, Magna Carta's relevance to New Zealand on the international stage. Third, Magna Carta and its protection of property rights. And finally, the practical implications of repealing Magna Carta if we were to follow the propositions of the prosecution tonight. So the first of those points concerns the idea that Magna Carta informs and strengthens the treaty claims and settlement process. So just as a bit of background, Magna Carta was premised on several constitutional ideals, including the idea that the monarch is subject to some constraints, the idea that no person or no institution is above the law, and finally that everyone is entitled to have their legal rights recognised equally before the courts. These constitutional ideals are crucial to the treaty settlement claims process. Magna Carta has become a powerful symbol of justice for the individual, and the Treaty of Waitangi, a powerful symbol of, amongst other things, collective justice for Māori. So this common foundation in justice, and more specifically for Māori redress, is what links the two in the modern age. As an example, Your Honour, a body such as the Waitangi Tribunal, where claims are always and only made against the Crown, is almost inconceivable if there was not a general acceptance that the powers of the state are limited by the rights of its citizens. This acceptance flows from Magna Carta. As an inverse example, if it was acceptable for a government to arbitrarily deprive citizens of their individual or, as the case may be, collective rights, would the government even engage in the treaty settlement negotiations process? So, in summary on this first point, the constitutional presumption that there ought to be redress for rights breaches has its seeds in Chapter 29 of Magna Carta, the chapter that remains in our law today, and has indeed flavoured the way we think about what is and what is not legitimate government action when it comes to the basic premise of treaty settlement negotiations. The second major point I'd like to move on to is Magna Carta on the international stage and its relevance to New Zealand. So Magna Carta is directly relevant to New Zealand because the way states think of Magna Carta informs the creation and development of international conventions and treaties. This in turn impacts domestic law as New Zealand makes provisions to incorporate these treaties and conventions. And I'd like to refer the court to many examples where there have been references to Magna Carta on the international stage that emphasise that the document is more than just its text and is at the forefront of global rights jurisprudence. The first example is Eleanor Roosevelt. And in 1948, she was the chair of the United Nations Human Rights Commission at the time of the adoption of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And she famously stated at the time that the Declaration may well become the international Magna Carta for all men everywhere. Nelson Mandela, speaking from the dock during the 1964 Riviona trial, expressed his admiration for Magna Carta. He said that it was held in veneration by Democrats worldwide. And indeed, countries that share the same constitutional heritage as New Zealand, such as that of the UK, where Prime Minister Sir Winston Churchill was advised that a copy of the original charter might reinforce a shared political heritage and secure the support of the United States in World War II. Thankfully, it did so, and with the help of some lateral thinking, we can say that Magna Carta won us the war in some senses. For American originalists, at least, Magna Carta has special lastingness. Their much revered Justice Antonin Scalia, at a speech to the Federalist Society, said that Magna Carta is with us every day. And indeed, three New Hampshire Republicans in 2012 took his words into effect and introduced a bill into their legislature requiring that all members of the General Court proposing bills and resolutions addressing individual rights and liberties shall include a direct quote from Magna Carta, which sets forth the article from which the individual right or liberty is derived. So the mental stability of these Republicans aside, we can at least see that Magna Carta has some relevance on the global international stage and is deeply embedded in the complex web of international human rights law and thought. Indeed, Magna Carta may be one of the most relevant pieces of legislation of the New Zealand statute book if and when states decide to come together as larger regional blocs, such as that of the European Union, as it will inform the way these states, and hopefully New Zealand, structures and interprets their new constitutions. Moreover, Magna Carta is more than just relevant to New Zealand in the 21st century. It is integral to our development in the global arena in defining who we are as a nation on the world stage. This is especially so, as I have illustrated, when New Zealand and other countries that share constitutional heritage in Magna Carta seek international support for whatever reason. It binds us together historically, legally, and politically, even with countries that do not have it part of this have it in part of their statute books. So to summarise this point on the international relevance of Magna Carta to New Zealand, Magna Carta, and at least its principles, can be seen as the almost universal baseline of rights at international law. It is directly relevant to New Zealand when we make provisions for treaties and conventions in our domestic law too. The third point I'd like to move on to tonight is Magna Carta and its relevance to property rights. So two cases have brought Magna Carta directly into the realm of tangible property rights and also coincidentally support the defence this evening, they being Cooper and Attorney General in 1996 and Waitakere City Council and Estate Homes Limited in 2006. And I would note that the latter of those cases took place in New Zealand's own Supreme Court. But also note that the case relied on by the prosecution, that of West Copenhagen, has at least been conclusively dealt with by the Supreme Court in Waitakere City Council, where Justice McGrath states on behalf of the court, the New Zealand Bill of Rights Act 1990 does not protect interests and property from expropriation, but the principal general measure of constitutional protection is under the Magna Carta, which requires that no one shall be disseised of his freehold but by the law of the land. And as we all know, having taken at least Laws 121, the Supreme Court is of much higher authority than whatever, with respect, Justice McEachin sat in. The second major case is that of Cooper and Attorney General, where Justice Baragwanath stated that we have no supreme law protection of property rights equivalent to the part of the US Fifth Amendment, which provides nor shall property be taken for public use without due compensation. And so one of the effects of this measure is to require that the power to expropriate is conferred by statute, and statutory practice is to confer entitlements to fair compensation where the legislature considers land as being taken for public purposes. So again, taking the example of the Public Works Act 1981 that the prosecution referred to, the Crown may compulsorily expropriate land for the purposes of public works, but there is, under Section 60, a heading that states there is a basic entitlement to compensation. So at least if the Magna Carta doesn't protect the disseise, or the disseisement, if that's even a word, of your freehold, the legacy of Magna Carta is the idea that the right to property should not be breached without, at minimum, some form of due process and redress. And that is embodied in Section 60 of the Public Works Act under its basic entitlement to compensation. The fourth and final point I'd like to take the court through tonight is the practical implications of repealing Magna Carta. The first subsidiary point under this is the idea that the development of Magna Carta's principles will be hindered and harm its development if we simply strike it off the statute book, as the prosecution allege. So as a basic premise, the prosecution agree with the defence that the principles of Magna Carta are of crucial importance, but with respect, the notion that its text ought to be repealed is an undesirable proposition. And the reason for this is that it fails to recognise that Magna Carta's principles have developed and continue to develop over time with continuous reference to the text. After all, principles, at least in the legal realm, are no more than ambulatory interpretations of significant texts, in this case Chapter 29 of Magna Carta. So just as an example, no one could plausibly suggests that the text of the Treaty of Waitangi is now irrelevant and obsolete simply because in 1987 President Cook and Co derived principles from its text, and we now continue to apply them in the courts and in legislation. Therefore, we ought to retain the text to allow us to continue development of the rights, values and principles that Magna Carta has come to symbolise, they being enunciated by my senior counsel. And as a subsidiary point to this, we may even give consideration to even reenacting Magna Carta to give effect to its principles and still keeping the text as well. Doing so can be achieved in much the same way as the Treaty of Waitangi Act 1975 did with the treaty.
We have effectively enacted it, haven't we? Reenacted it.
Magna Carta, you're on?
Yes.
Well, yes, we have, but at least the version we have had is still set in the past. And if we want to keep the principles and keep developing those principles over time, we need to keep the text. And the basic idea is that people usually unwittingly invoke Magna Carta without realizing that they're doing so in everyday life. And they think about notions of natural justice, due process, and fairness. And Magna Carta, therefore, is clearly relevant to them, but they lack a tangible mechanism with which they can refer to, because the principles of Magna Carta are not given effect to in the legislation that we currently have. So, by having a Magna Carta Act that keeps the text and gives effects to its principles, we can recognise more substantially the weight that citizens place on these basic, almost unalterable rights. Further, the prosecution's submission that Magna Carta's principles are duly recognised in other pieces of legislation, namely the New Zealand Bill of Rights Act 1919, or the Human Rights Act, or the Constitution Act, is a moot point if they want to keep Magna Carta's principles but do away with its text. So, doing so, that is, repealing Magna Carta, would unduly hinder constitutional evolution by liquidating the principles we have derived from Magna Carta and siphoning them from the important historical context from where they came. Principles can no longer be developed if they don't have a text at least to refer to, or they will be developed wrongly in our constitutional evolution. May be helpful to the court if I provide a summary of my points tonight. They are Magna Carta's crucial importance to the Treaty of Waitangi negotiations settlement process, Magna Carta's significant influence is the base consideration for many international treaties and laws, which New Zealand then makes provisions for in its domestic law, and Magna Carta being paramount to securing and reinforcing shared state bonds. Third, Magna Carta's constitutional protection of property rights, and finally, Magna Carta's practical relevance to New Zealanders and the harms that would result if we were to strike it off the statute book. If Your Honour pleases, those are the eminent scholarly and erudite submissions of the defence.
Mr. Redcroft.
Mr. Hodder.
Please, Your Honour, freely acknowledge the eloquence of my learned friends for the defence. Heroic attempts to gloss over unattractive realities, ultimately unsuccessful, of course. But a few points that I might mention by way of a brief reply. Firstly, in terms of the Public Works Act, the Public Works Act does personify the principle that if things are taken away for the public good, then the public should pay for them. But if you look at the Resource Management Act, you find the reverse. There is no compensation for effectively sterilising property under resource management regimes. And that was in part what I meant when I said that in New Zealand, the protection of property rights is many degrees below that in the United States of America. In terms of the World War II, which I take seriously, having a tragic interest in military history, that's a little unkind, sir, as I suspect we're just about contemporaries, but my understanding of World War II is that it was one on the Eastern Front where I don't think Magna Carta had a great role to play. In terms of the treaty, I mean, I ask you to stand back and think about the treaty in the context of Magna Carta. Well, two things, really. The first is that Magna Carta is an indication not of indigenous rights. The Saxons were having a pretty hard time in the 12th century and the 13th century. But more importantly, the treaty process is a truly ingenious way of dealing with community interests for somewhere between national interest and individual interests or rights. It is a political process. It's developed uniquely for New Zealand conditions. It reflects a whole series of matters. To try and trace it back to Magna Carta is, in a sense, overstretching the matter by some distance.
But the treaty did promise Maori the rights of British citizens, which didn't include the Magna Carta rights.
Well, the fish weirs and those sort of things were an issue that had to be sorted out. But
yeah, not so much the fish weirs and the Thames, but rights not to be deprived of property.
And that
didn't mean well
for quite a long time, did it? So, no. In a sense, I accept that the principles behind the treaty were informed by 19th century English thinking, and in the 19th century, Magna Carta was in the forefront of many of the approaches to English law. It is effectively the kind of thing that's reflected in the Kipling authority that I cited to Your Honour. There's reference to the Law Commission's Imperial Legislation in Force report of 1987, in which I discovered only this morning that I was a signatory to the proposition that Magna Carta was
A living instrument.
An important instrument. But in fact, reading it more carefully, and I'm about to blame Sir Kenneth Keith, who's with whose drafting I wouldn't have dreamed of interfering at the time. But in fact, what the Commission did say was that historic promises being made in the Magna Carta and the Petition of Right and the Bill of Rights and the Act of Settlement. In fact, it was the whole collection of those statutes, of which Magna Carta, can I say for the present purposes, was by far the least significant, which underpins what was said in the Law Commission. Learned friend Ms. Theron took us to a whole series of entertainments that have been enjoyed for this this year in relation to Magna Carta, which I suspect were mostly driven by Americans. But all that proves in my submission is that bread and circuses are always popular, and any excuse will do. But it's got nothing to do with important matters such as maintenance of the rule of law. The other thing that is slightly sobering is, and it comes back to my point that we're focusing or getting distracted from the important issues. One of the issues that we haven't been focusing on as a community or a country is the fact that, under poor advice no doubt, the current government is hell-bent on repealing Section 3.2 of the Supreme Court Act, but it hasn't really done so. That is the provision that refers to parliamentary sovereignty and the rule of law. Now, why would you repeal that? And in fact, the minister was quoted in the professional magazine Law Talk as saying, well, it didn't really matter. We all knew we had the rule of law and parliamentary sovereignty, so why do you want it on the statute book? Well, if that's a fair question, then Magna Carta goes along as a footnote. In the end, the submission for the prosecution is that while Magna Carta is thoroughly deserving of a climate-controlled glass case, it has no place in serious political and legal discourse. That has no place on the statute book. And those, if you're on pleases, are the submissions for the prosecution.
Thank you. I'll just rip off. No. Hancock's Half Hour was a television program that will be recalled only by those who are at least as stricken with years as me. And I'm looking at you, Sir Kenneth, you, Justice Arnold, and yes, the youthful Mr. Hodder. In a 1959 episode, Tony Hancock was playing the role of the foreman of a jury. This in a takeoff of Henry Fonda in 12 Angry Men. Appealing to his fellow jurors for an acquittal, he asked three rhetorical questions. Does Magna Carta mean nothing to you? There was a pause. Did she die in vain? Another pause. Brave Hungarian peasant girl who forced King John to sign the pledge at Runnymede and close the boozers at 10:30, is all this to be forgotten? The fence would say no. Another take on the Magna Carta comes from 1066 and all that. The barons compelled John to sign the Magna Charta, which said, A, that no one was to be put to death save for some reason, except the common people. B, that everyone should be free except the common people. D, that the baron should not be tried except by a special jury of other barons. That would be because they would only they would understand each other. The Magna Charta was therefore the chief cause of democracy in England and thus a good thing for everyone except the common people. Perhaps this is a little close to the mark, perhaps as Mr. Hodder would suggest. In 1974, the American philosopher Thomas Nagel published a paper titled, What is it like to be a bat? The philosophical issues he explored fortunately lie beyond the scope of this evening's business. What is at least tangentially material, however, is his proposition that although we can think about what it would be like to be, but what it would be like to fly, to navigate by echolocation, to hang upside down, and even to eat bugs, we cannot create in our minds the consciousness or mindset of a bat, so we can't really understand what it's like to be a bat. In a similar, although not obviously identical way, it's difficult to recreate with any hope of accuracy the thinking of King John on the one hand and on the other his opponents, who, as I understand it, included his much maligned Sheriff of Nottingham. There's precious little contemporary evidence as to what happened in 1215. As far as I'm aware, two documents that may have been used as drafts of or models for parts of Magna Carta. No doubt everyone was looking to protect and advance their interests, and at a reasonably high level of generality we can identify those interests. But the detail was a function of then social and contemporary
social and economic conditions, particularly associated with feudalism, political theories, views as to right and wrong, operations of very rudimentary government and judicial institutions, and the very particular events which gave rise to the crisis of 1215. This context is now incomprehensible to all but serious aficionados of Angevin history. Most of the chapters of the Magna Carta have no contemporary significance. As a recent article in the New Yorker noted, most of the charter concerns feudal financial arrangements, sockage, burgage and scutage, obsolete measures and descriptions of land and of husbandry, wapentakes and wainages, and obscure instruments for the seizure and inheritance of estates, the seizin and mort d'ancestor. Men who live outside the forest are not henceforth to come before our justices of the forest through the common summonses unless they are in a plea, one article begins. It's clear that these articles and any underlying purpose they had are no longer of practical moment, as Mr. Hodder contended. They simply don't matter. But in contradistinction, however, is the language of chapters 39 and 40, which via chapter 29 of the 1297 version of the Magna Carta still form part of our law. No freeman shall be taken or imprisoned or be deceased of his freehold or liberties or free customs or be outlawed or exiled or any otherwise destroyed, nor will we pass upon him, nor condemn him, but by lawful judgment of his peers or by the law of the land. In chapter 40, we'll sell to no man, nor will we deny or defer to any man either justice or right. Perhaps they can be seen as speaking to us down the ages, expressing propositions sanctified by antiquity and significant now as ever. Whether this is so, I see as being, at least at a high level, the key issue in the trial. There certainly seems to be much good stuff and contemporary resonance in chapters 39 and 40. Freeman, surely in anticipation of the line attributed falsely, unfortunately, to Lord Mansfield, that the air of England has long been too pure for a slave, and every man is free who breathes it. Lawful judgment of his peers, plainly an early manifestation of the right to trial by jury. No detention except as allowed by the law of the land. Crikey, that's the law of habeas corpus in a nutshell. Law of the land, a literal translation of the original Latin legum terrae. Interesting to me, with my half-remembered Latin, that the word used was terra, or land, rather than regnum or kingdom. Perhaps what was intended even then was due process of law. And there's no doubt a sense in which chapter 39 anticipated, and perhaps an earlier chapter as well, anticipated current thinking as to expropriation of property and entitlement to compensation. In the 17th century, Sir Edward Coke dusted off the Magna Carta. He described chapters 39 to 40 as pure gold, and he deployed the charter in the contest between Parliament and the Crown, which led up to the Petition of Right, which unsurprisingly reflected his views on Magna Carta as he drafted it, and then after his death, the Civil War. It's fair to say that Oliver Cromwell may not have been entirely convinced by Sir Edward's rhetoric. He referred to the Magna Carta as Magna Fata, and consistently, and perhaps with his interest in matters Irish, called a Petition of Right, which incorporated largely Cook's thinking about the Magna Carta as the Petition of Shite. But Cromwell's reservations notwithstanding, the Magna Carta became firmly ensconced in the narratives which surround the Whig view of history. Unsurprisingly, it therefore came to be relied on by the American colonists in their struggle for independence, and its language still features in American legal instruments such as constitutions, charters and judgments. Mr. Hodder and Ms. Pirani, however, have much material to work with. The 1215 charter was not particularly original, save perhaps for enforcement mechanisms which were noticeably absent from all reissued versions. The expression freeman was not an assertion that all were free, rather it distinguished those who were free from those who weren't, in particular those who made up the villainage, which constituted about half the population. The key driver of trial by jury was not the Magna Carta, but Pope Innocent III's abolition of the institution of trial by ordeal, which only coincidentally also occurred in 1215. connection between Magna Carta and the law of habeas corpus prior to the 17th century is murky, to say the least, and there's scholarly debate as to whether legem terrae really can be translated as due process of law. The Magna Carta was lost sight of, it's not even referred to in Shakespeare's King John, and it only came to be revived by Sir Edward Cook in the 17th century. So coming back to what De Batt's think analogy, I don't think it possible now to construe chapters 39 and 40 in accordance with the requirements of statutory interpretation, that is, in line with their text and in light of their purpose. It's hard to see them as capable of direct legal application. They scarcely feature in recent jurisprudence in New Zealand, England, Wales and Australia, and where discussed, it's in the context almost always of an explanation as to why arguments founded on them, usually advanced by self-represented litigants, must fail. So I rather thought Ms. Pirani made a telling point when she suggested that the Magna Carta could be repealed from the New Zealand statute book and no one would notice any difference. Some of these criticisms, however, are a little originalist, even for my liking. The Magna Carta was reissued many times, sometimes with amendments and amplifications. The limitation of scope of Chapter 39 to Freeman was abandoned in the 14th century. The expression due process, which may have been implicit in the 1215 version, appeared explicitly in the same century. There's certainly a coincidence of thinking between Chapter 39 and the law of habeas corpus, and it was influential in the development of the law of habeas corpus in the 17th century. And one of the reasons why the Magna Carta is not relied on in litigation is that there's now no need to do so, because the effect of chapters 39 and 40 are now so embedded in our legal fabric. So that brings me to the symbolism argument that what's significant about the Magna Carta is not what it meant or was thought to mean in 1215, but what it stands for. It doesn't really matter that by the political and legal conceptions of the time, feudal kings were not absolute monarchs, or that there are earlier charters which contain similar promises. It's not critical that some of the successors of King John acted as if they were absolute monarchs, and I'm inclined to accept that Sir Edward Cook's reliance on the pure gold of chapters 39 and 40 was bad history and bad legal history too. But there is a potent combination of the symbolism of what happened at Runnymede, a practical and not theoretical demonstration of the limits of royal power, and secondly, the processes of amplification, accretion and rhetoric by which the language of chapters 39 and 40 have become inextricably mixed up with the major elements of what we now call the rule of law. There remains, however, a final challenge to the relevance of Magna Carta, which must be addressed. Political arguments about Magna Carta have in the past reflected a way of thinking and a pattern of political discourse which, while still not unknown, is not as common as it once was, a harking back to a golden past rather than looking forward to a brand spanking new future. It was a style of thinking which in England in the 17th century made revolution palatable to those of a conservative disposition, and likewise in America in the 18th century. It's recently been criticised by Lord Sumption. Ultimately, one's attitude to political myths of this kind depends on where one situates one's golden age. Those who created the myths that surround Magna Carta located their golden age in the past. Their ideal was the recapture of an imagined paradise lost. To Cook and his generation, it really mattered that the common law, as they understood it in the 17th century, should have existed in much the same form since the days of King Alfred or the legendary Brutus the Trojan. It really mattered that it should have been encapsulated in Magna Carta. The authority of their legal program depended in large measure on its supposed antiquity. Otherwise, they would have been mere revolutionaries and not the respectable English gentlemen that they believed themselves to be. Today, the pendulum has swung the other way. Medieval has become a synonym for barbarous. We're frighteningly ignorant of the past, in large measure because we no longer look to it as a source of inspiration. We're all revolutionaries now, controlling our own fate. So when we commemorate Magna Carta, perhaps the first question we should ask ourselves is this: do we really need the force of myth to sustain our belief in democracy? Do we need to derive our belief in democracy and the rule of law from a group of muscular conservative millionaires from the north of England who thought in French, knew no Latin or English,
and died more than three quarters of a millennium ago. I rather hope not. So that puts in slightly different language the argument advanced by Mr. Hodder and Ms. Pirani that the myths serve no good purpose, indeed are misleading and dangerous. Although Lord Sumption's remarks were couched in provocative terms, his appeal is to clear and rational thinking and is attractive for that reason. I nonetheless find it not entirely convincing. I agree we should support the rule of law because it's the right thing to do. That aspects of the rule of law have ancient roots, in that sense, is neither here nor there. As Ms. Pirani said, the rule of law should be celebrated in its own right. The disadvantages of the alternatives can be demonstrated by reasonably recent experience, and in light of that, the rights and wrongs of King John's civil war are beside the point. And to all of that extent, I agree with Lord Sumption and with the arguments advanced. We are, however, humans and not clear-thinking and rational Vulcans like Mr. Spock. And tradition and symbolism have a part to play in our thinking and the decisions we reach. When the rule of law is challenged, it's not irrelevant to consider that the rule of law in some form or another has been recognised, although not always observed, and often testing times. And such recognition has not had obviously detrimental effects on the development of society. Indeed, at the risk of being thought myself to subscribe to the Whig interpretation of history, I think that society is all the better for it. And some, perhaps many, still find it easier to take a stand if it's supported by what they and others see as honourable tradition. I think Mr. Roycroft made the valuable point that the Treaty of Waitangi is not immaterial in this context. That treaty extended to Maori the rights of British citizens, rights which in 1840 were undoubtedly seen as encompassing chapters 39 and 40 of the Magna Carta. So if the traditions around the Magna Carta are exaggerated, as I accept they are, they nonetheless, along with the associated symbolism, seem to me to buttress our current conception of the rule of law, and at least to that extent the Magna Carta remains relevant and not obsolete. So accordingly, I conclude the charge has not been made out.
The Honourable will now retire.